Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up the world, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when live and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. This is MJ Network. In memory of my sister, Marcia Joyce, Dr. George Cavuto is with us today, and we're going to talk about iatrogenic learning disabilities, reading disorders, how to treat them, how you deal with them, and the self-fulfilling prophecy, and a whole lot more. Good morning and welcome to MJ Network.
Good morning, Fran. Good morning to all your listeners. Pleasure to be with you.
This is going to be fun and challenging, people. We're going to get this. Okay. The learning iatrogenic learning disabilities by John S. Kernan is defined as a belief that a number of children with iatrogenic learning disabilities is processing direct in proportion to proliferation of programs to treat their educational handicaps. A lot of teachers I know, after working with children with learning disabilities, have no idea how to fix it, have no idea what they are, and a lot of children feel that they can't do it. They give up before they start. So the pressure to establish preventive and remedial programs and the shortage of qualified teachers has forced educators to hire increasing numbers of inadequately trained personnel. And that I could tell you. So, Dr. Cavuto, how would you define iatrogenic disorders, and what kind of reading disorders are most paramount with kids?
Good question, Fran. It's a perfect place to start, as I knew it would be. An iatrogenic disorder, generically, first of all, we got the term from the medical community, and iatrogenic disorder or medical disorder is a disease, affliction, disability caused by the treatment that the patient received.
Mm-hmm.
And needless to say, if a group of doctors held a medical convention, that wouldn't be high on their list, because none of us like to talk about the bad side of our profession. But iatrogenic disorders are, in fact, every time we take a pill, there's all those side effects that they have to give you, right? Okay? The term was almost exclusively used in medicine. It still is being used in medicine a lot, but very rarely would you find anything in education. But I got interested in this a while ago because I've always been very much opposed to labeling and very much opposed to putting restrictions on youngsters at 4 or 5 and 6 years old. And iatrogenic disorder in education would be defined as a reading problem caused by the instruction the child is receiving. And there are, let's just say, in my opinion, a plethora of children who have iatrogenic disorders. And when you say iatrogenic learning disability, the only problem with that article, and it was a good article, both of us had difficulty retrieving it. But the problem with that is iatrogenic learning disability is almost an oxymoron, because by calling something a disability, you already are labeling that child and restricting him, yes?
Mm-hmm.
So there are, let me just say this to be not too all that wordy. In my opinion, and in the research, 95% of children, 95 to 99% of children labeled learning disabled have as their primary area of disability reading and or writing, mostly both, okay? That being the case, why must we assign these labels to them? Because in my opinion, why don't we just say they're having a lot of difficulty in reading? They're having reading challenges. They're at this stage, they're very poor readers, instead of giving them the label. The label becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and moreover, and then I'm going to let you jump in, and then moreover, the programs that are concocted for these children, and there are many of them, 16 million of them labeled in the United States last year, learning disabled, 16 million, and that's not counting ADD, ADHD, because they come under other health impaired. But in my opinion, this is and has been a travesty. And what is it? If you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. So this warning should be valuable.
No, I agree. And I have this right in front of me. And after teaching children with learning disabilities for quite a number of years, they never realized that they were behind because I wouldn't let them think that. The
Perfect.
Teachers would
exactly.
send them. They used to sneak down for reading even if they didn't supposed to be.
Yes, exactly.
They had a lot of the teachers gave them low self-esteem, contributed to his poor self-image, creating self-prophecies that automatically they would fail. And a lot of the teachers that I work with, I said to them, you need to treat them like everybody else, and you need to do the lessons with everybody else. And when I taught first grade, they said, you have a bottom group. They didn't know it. Teachers have a negative attitude, and at times, I've heard teachers reading fluently and tell the child, don't read because you can't read fluently or you don't understand what you're reading. Favoritism, they don't care, intolerant, inconsistent. That's something that has to be changed. And I see it because
yes.
I know that my nephew is in a learning disability class, and I said to him, if you need help, he said, no, I'm fine.
Yeah.
Sometimes they don't want to admit that there's a problem, and they're
well. You know what, Fern? I think that's a very astute comment, and I'm not being patronizing because that's exactly right. I mean, who among us wants to be told that you're deficient in some way? That especially when it's clouded in some kind of quasi medical terminology. You don't even understand. I'll give you in my favorite one that I'm just going to refer to this as a hoax because it was a hoax. An auditory processing difficulty. Huh? We never used that term came about. I'm going to say 15 years ago, and all of a sudden there were all these children who had auditory processing difficulties. And Fran, more than a few friends and colleagues whose relatives or grown children have become audiologists and speech pathologists. All of a sudden, the audiologists started testing for auditory processing difficulty. Insurance would cover it, and they would tell me, well, he has auditory processing difficulty, George. Do you see that? I said, no, can you tell me what an auditory processing difficulty is? Jeannie, George, you have a PhD in this area, auditory processing, it's having difficulty processing auditorily. I said, no, that's a circumlocution. You can't define the word with the words. Nonsense, friend, absolute nonsense. In fact, now you're not hearing that as much because it's gone out of vogue. It's no longer the fad of the season. But again, all those children who were probably just not reading all that well, they know they're not reading that well, but all of a sudden they're told, you have a auditory processing difficulty, and now they're, I'm not going to say doomed, but I'm going to say now they're convinced there's something wrong with them. Yes?
I agree.
The one thing
I know is that you don't tell them that, ever. I have never, ever said to a child that you're behind, and I've never said you can't do it. I think I told this once before. I taught fifth grade, and I'll never forget, at 6:30 in the morning, this group of boys walked in and said, we can't read, we don't know the alphabet. And I just broke my heart. I said, well, who told you that? Well, they told us we can't learn. I go, give me an hour and you'll be reading 200 words. And they were.
There's no such thing
as you can't learn. It's a matter of developing a program that adheres to their specific abilities to learn.
Yes,
and some children can't learn phonics.
Yeah,
they can learn something else.
Yeah, and if I may, it also has an enormous amount to do with that which I know, because I know you, and you were one of my star students way back when. And it also has a lot to do with the teacher's perception of that child and how he or she conveys that perception to the child. And if that teacher, even with the best intentions, conveys to the child that there's something wrong with him, you know what? There's something wrong with him. All right? Or he now believes there's something wrong with him. All right? I was much more comfortable in the 50s and 60s, even though that's when I was kind of growing up. But when I started college in the early 70s, I was much more comfortable when they said this youngster, you know, he's having difficulty in reading. All of a sudden, Samuel Kirk coined the term learning disability. I think that was in the early 60s. And this is a quote, he actually rued the day he ever came up with that term. Because when they asked him to define it, he said, I really don't even know what a learning disability is. What I meant by that is someone's having difficulty learning. Well, that's fine, but don't call it a disability. Once you call it a disability, then you know what happened. The field exploded, right?
Yeah, it sounds like a disease.
Oh, yes, absolutely, absolutely. So in terms of where we started, iatrogenic reading disorder is a reading disorder caused. I'm not even going to say learning disability. That's why I probably was crazy about the title of that article. It's oxymoronic. But the a reading program designed that, in my view, is absolutely iatrogenic is, I'll name a few. I'll start out with the biggest one, Wilson, the Wilson reading program, okay, where you tap out words, the children having difficulty, and then they have to start tapping out words. Okay, I won't go into a big tirade of that, but I can, but I won't. Orton-Gillingham, another one that is iatrogenic. Words in color, okay?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Unbelievable. I mean, there are just loads of them. And the reason why I say they're iatrogenic is because when any human being is asked to do a task that is not related to the real task, we call that ecologically invalid, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And there are two types of tests, ecologically valid and ecologically invalid. To look at a page of print and try to read it, okay, using all three language cueing systems, phonics, semantics, and syntax, that's absolutely ecologically valid. No one can argue with that. There's not even a debate. I will debate anyone about that. So will the late Noam Chomsky, okay? However, looking at a page of print and then deciding how you're going to tap it out, that is absolutely ecologically invalid. And when you give a child a test that it's ecologically invalid, you are, in fact, causing, and if he was already not very good at reading, we'll use the word exacerbating an existing difficulty. Okay? And that's definitely iatrogenic in my opinion. Definitely. Did you know in Orton-Gillingham, if you look at the Orton-Gillingham manual, there's at least 8 to 10 pages that discourage the youngster from doing outside reading. Discourage the youngster from doing outside reading. Why? Because they say, well, if he does outside reading, he's going to come across words that are not, don't have the spelling patterns like we do in Orton-Gillingham, and as a result, he'll get confused. That's like telling me, you want to get good at tennis, don't play. You want to get good at tennis, don't practice. I mean, that in and of itself is a patently ridiculous statement to be placed in a reading manual, and not just to place in the manual, but to convince the children, no, no, don't let him read that book. Oh, he's enjoying this book at home. No, not good. It's really because he's going to see a lot of words that are, outlaw words. They don't fall into the patterns. Terrible, terrible, terrible. I could go on and on and on, but I want to give you a chance to ask me another question.
Okay, my thing here, too, I just printed out something because I'm getting really
sure.
good at research, people. I've been doing a lot of research the last couple of weeks.
Uh-huh.
And, my niece is taking criminal services, and I'm great at crime mapping and crime scenes. I learned a lot. I noticed that a lot of times, and after teaching reading for 1,000 years, and I listen to people talking, and I don't try not to interrupt, but it's hard sometimes, learning to read can be a challenge when the teacher feels that the children can't learn. And when the teacher expresses herself or himself and says, well, they're in the bottom group, so what? And, everybody has reading groups, and they didn't know what group they were in because I just say, 3, 2, 1, whatever, and they didn't have numbers. So a lot of the teachers I've said to, how do you know that they're reading disabled? How do you know that when they come in, they just were not taught the right way? And some kids can't learn with phonics. Some people need, sight, sound, kinesthetic. So they have difficulty rhyming. So what? They individual sounds, following directions. Sometimes I've noticed that teachers are teaching fluency. They're not teaching them to comprehend. They're just teaching them to read like word callers and speed readers.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And a lot of times the teachers don't know, and they meet with the reading specialists when they talk to me. They get the answers. But does every child, this is a question that I've said to many of my friends that are in special ed, is every child that has a reading disability, is it that they were not taught the right way? They didn't know how to read when they came in, like those boys that read by the end of the year, they were on grade 5 level, by the way, people, because they just didn't know that they couldn't learn. They didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Do they need an evaluation? I mean, do you have to put them through an eligibility for special ed when they come in and they were not taught because they came from another country? What do you do then? And
yeah.
How do you get them to understand, don't worry about it, you're going to be a success?
Yeah. Anytime we do anything in education, and both of us have we have a huge advantage in not doing this just from the ivory tower, because both of us have taught at the college, university level besides public schools, we've done it. We've worked with kids. I know I spent 25 years in public school classrooms before moving on to the academy. And we don't have to talk in the abstract. We've seen it. And once a child, in fact, I also have the luxury of having my own private reading center where I tested over the course of 38 years, probably 4,000, 5,000 children on the one-to-one basis all by myself. And then I would talk with the parents the following week. These children would walk in the room from the waiting room, and they would be looking at the floor instead of giving you eye contact. And you know what that is. That's poor self-image, right? And I, hey, handsome, nice to see you. Come on up. All of a sudden, he'd brighten up, and he'd come in the room. We'd sit down, and I'd start chatting with him. And last thing I talked about was reading, of course. What do you like to do? Da-da-da. And what kinds of things, does mom work? Yeah, what does she do? What is that? And we talk about family, brothers, sisters. And we finally get to school and I get to reading. And I love this, but by the time I get to reading, I say, can I ask you something? Now, at this point, I've already won them over because I'm just being nice to them and not harping on any kind of, they're just walking in the door. They know they must have some kind of difficulty, right? But I don't make them feel that way. I make them feel valued. And the eyes then all of a sudden look down and say, let's talk about school a little bit. What's your favorite subject? Gym. Okay. And that's gym is great. What else? I like recess. Okay. What's your worst subject? Reading. I had one kid say, what do you think I'm here? But He was a piece of work. He was great. I started laughing. But that same youngster who said that to me, I asked him about reading, and I said, let me ask you a question. When you read, which gives you more difficulty, actually reading the words on the page or remembering and understanding that which you've read? Now, Fran, I've asked that question of all of those 4,000-plus kids. Someone asked me the other day, so I actually tabulated how many, and it's over 4,000. You know what? I then spend the next hour and a half doing one-to-one reading and language testing with the youngster, and they're almost always right. They know where their problems are. I think the one little boy said to me, well, Dr. C, I could call you, right? Yeah, Dr. C is great. Dr. C, I can't read the words, so how am I going to understand what I read, what I read, right? So then I spent the next hour and a half confirming what he told me, right? So, with all these many people, is that we get off to a good start, and I do all the testing, and I don't lie to them, and I said, yep, you're right, you have a lot of difficulty figuring out words. So you know what we're going to do? Instead of having you read this passage silently and then out loud, and he looked at it as a pre-prima passage or a prima passage, and he said, no, I said, I know, you were right, you have a lot of difficulty reading words. I'm going to try something different. I'm going to go to a listening conference, which is a wonderful measure of reading potential. And all of a sudden, he passes the first grade, passes the second grade, passes the third grade, passes the fourth grade, and he's only in second grade. So I say, you know what? You just passed the fourth grade passage. All of a sudden, this kid is beaming. He said, well, I'm really good at it. I said, yes, you are. You're great. Like, the reason why you're having difficulty is generating. So that's what our job is to do, to help you figure out the words. Right? And, you know, to me, that's just so very positive, right? This is the opposite of iatrogenic, right? It's also the opposite of labeling. It's also the opposite of the self-fulfilling prophecy, which we'll get into in a little while. But you're absolutely right. To convey to children that they can do it is so critically important, critically important.
I know when I taught fifth grade, and I know that the teachers sort of made them feel as if, you know, you can't do it. And they would come down and go, no worry about it, she'll take care of it. I learned something all by myself after taking the reading masters and everything, that I brought material in that was interesting to them, but was on their independent level. And I said, you know what, we're going to read this so that you get an idea of how much easier it is to understand something. And we reread it, they understood it. And I asked simple questions like who, what, where, when, and when, why. And even these kids that came in the morning at 6:30 in the morning so I couldn't have my coffee, for real, came in, they woke me up. I go like, what? They didn't know. They said to me, well, I said, where did you come from? They came from foreign countries. They were never taught to read. I said, if you're never taught to read, you can't say that you can't learn. And I picked a program. I used a little of everything, the Fran Lewis Make Up Your Own Mind program. And like I said, within an hour, they were reading 200 words. Then the next day I came in and I said, okay, we're going to try this reading series. And whatever worked. By the end of the first month, they were reading on, you know, like second grade. By the end of the year, they were reading close to fifth grade, some of them above. And then one of them said to me, how did you do that? I said, I didn't do anything. You did. You just decided that you were going to learn. You have
exactly.
It's an attitude. It's an attitude. And the teachers would send them down, and they would say, well, they didn't know they were there. They snuck in. But the regular reading groups, they would come down, oh, my bottom group, I go, I don't want to hear the word. Don't ever tell me the word bottom. Just tell me my group. I mean, I'll never forget the day that the teacher said they couldn't come because they got in trouble with her. I said, that'll be the day.
Yeah.
But what are the most, and I mean, I listen to people talk all the time. I try not to. And I try not to, really. And they said, they don't know how to read, or I don't know how to do this. And there's like a negative kind of feeling for their children get. What are the most prevalent reading disorders that most, the minute somebody walks in, they can read, they call them dyslexic, even if they're not.
Yeah.
Or they'll say, I have a list here, they have trouble decoding, fluency, poor reading comprehension. So sometimes I would just read something to them and ask them questions, and I would say, focus on the words, don't worry about the print. And that does help. So what is the best way, what is the most, why do people automatically say they're dyslexic when they're really not?
To be honest with you, I'm laughing because something happened. My wife was away for a few days. She went down to North Carolina to see her sister. So I was a bachelor. So I could cook maybe an egg on a good day. So I usually hit the restaurant from dinner time. In any case, so let me first answer your question. There's no doubt about it. The most prevalent diagnosis for learning disabled kids is dyslexia. And why is dyslexia? 95% of these 16 million children are labeled learning disabled. We know that virtually all of them can read and write. Find me a youngster who can read and write on grade level. He is not going to be in a resource room. He is not going to be in a resource room. In fact, even if his math is terrible, doesn't matter. In fact, if he could read well, but his spelling is lousy, he's not going to be in a resource room. It's basically the reading. The writing, of course, should come along. But if a youngster is reading third grade, reading on a third grade level, you're not going to find him coming before the Committee on Special Ed. So the answer to your question is it's the most prevalent label for learning disabled children is dyslexia. And again, to get back to the iatrogenic, here's a youngster who, let's say he's in first grade, because now we label them in kindergarten with these darn labels. But let's say he's in first grade and he now goes before the Committee on Special Ed. Now the parents are called in. Now they're told he's dyslexic. And you know what? Here's this little boy or little girl who knew that he or she was not just not getting it, but was having fun with the other kids, was, enjoying school, except when he had to read, and kind of felt somewhat normal. But again, human beings are keenly aware of their deficiencies, but knew the reading wasn't coming along. But now someone's telling him he's got this I'm gonna tell him what it is, this vaguely defined medical sounding problem. Now all of a sudden he's no longer just Bradley or Brenda. He's Bradley, Brenda, disabled child. So that's the answer to your question, friend. The answer is, what is the most prevalent diagnosis? They call it a diagnosis because they use medical terminology. I refuse to use that term. I say assessment when I'm doing them. And I don't call my reading and learning center that I had from 1973 to 2011. I never called it my practice. I went to a few learning disability conferences, and they all talked about their practices. They don't have a practice. Give me a break. They're not medical doctors. I'm sorry if I'm offending anyone, but this matters. This really matters. So then we take these children who are labeled dyslexic, and we put them in programs like the most popular one is Wilson right now. And it's been the most popular one for 10 years. Lord knows why. It must be they have good salesmen. Because if, friend, isn't it a simple litmus test for a program, in my opinion, is this, of a reading program. If the teacher, who probably has at least a bachelor's, if not a master's degree in education, okay, has difficulty himself with the program, has difficulty learning the program, and is nervous that the Wilson people are going to come in and observe them, if that's the case, what are we doing giving that program to a first, second, third grade child who's deficient in reading? It's ridiculous. And by the way, I don't say that in a hypothetical. I had several teachers who worked with me at my private office who all had master's degrees in reading, who their district all of a sudden implemented Wilson, and would come to me and say, George, I'm embarrassed, but I'm being observed tomorrow, and I'm nervous. This is hard as heck. I'm not sure when to tap, the open, the close. Unbelievable. Friend, if someone who's good at it can't do it, the task is ecologically invalid. We shouldn't be having children do it. And another one, and you know this well, because this phonemic awareness, phonological awareness, it makes sense. You have, is English perfectly phonetic? No, it's not. We have 26 letters trying to make 44 sounds. That's why we have words like caught and through and though and you and mother. None of which sound down, okay? But that's because we have 26 letters trying to make 44 sounds. Spanish and Italian, that words sound out perfectly. Words sound out perfectly in those two languages because you have one-to-one relationships between the sounds and the letters. Okay, so we already start out with it. A lot of people say English. My God, it's so hard to learn. A lot of people who are bilingual, trilingual, multilingual, even with more than two or three. And they said, my God, the English is so much more difficult than Italian and Spanish and several other languages. All right. So phonological awareness has become a real buzzword in education. So we'll give the phonemic awareness, same thing. And we'll give the youngster a task like taking sounds and putting them together. B-ang, bang. Right, we'll say them out loud. And k-ap-ten, and they have to integrate them. I have no problem with that. That's incredibly ecologically valid. And for a kid who's having difficulty doing that out loud as an activity, by the way, if you want to be even more ecologically valid, read poetry to them. There was a little girl who had a little curl right in the middle of her forehead. When she was good, she was very, very good. When she was bad, she was horrid. Poems are a great way to develop a phonemic awareness. However, instead of just doing things like that are ecologically valid, we do, that's part of phonological awareness training, we take words, we give them to the youngster, and then he has to break the word down into its phonemic element. Friend, that's incredibly difficult.
I know.
I've tried that with my graduate students. The integration, they have no problem. K-R, pen, carpenter, piece of cake. Okay. How about this one? Let's try this one. Captain. What I want you to do, I'm saying the word. Can you give me all the sounds that make up captain? We're talking about graduate students. To do this with children should be against the law. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. But yet it's being done as we speak in many classrooms across the country. And again, it's such a, it's not really a fine line in my opinion, but I happen to have a PhD in reading, and you have PhDs in other areas, including education. And we both know that there are a lot of teachers who just don't have a background in reading, or they're being forced to do that which the district has adopted. And they don't question it. If we just use that very simple litmus test, if the teacher is having difficulty with it, use it for one thing, throw it out the window. Use it to start the barbecue. So in my opinion, that kind of thing can make youngsters feel that's a difficulty that can be called iatrogenic, because if you already had the reading problem, by doing that you're exacerbating it. So that becomes iatrogenic. Iatrogenic isn't something you're born with; it's something that happens to you based upon the instruction you're getting, whether it's in medicine or education.
That's true. I noticed that a lot of times. I never stuck to the reading program. I made up my own. It was Lippincott or it was the first time I taught first grade was Bank Street. And there are a lot of children that can't learn but auditory. A lot of them can learn visual. But then I realize sometimes, and a lot of teachers won't bother, And I would say to them, I would say the word or sound it or whatever, and they would say, I can't hear you, which meant they had a hearing problem, so I had to check that out. A lot of times they might need glasses, and that might solve the problem too. And a lot of times it did. But it also is an attitude that you have towards your class and your reading. And I taught only children that had learning that were behind in level. I taught double grades. And everybody said to me, well, how could you do that? I said, it's real simple. I got smart fourth grade and smart fifth grade. They didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
It's in your attitude, too. Because if children walk into your room, and I'll never forget this ever. I had a 5-6 class, and I was absent for 25 minutes, for real. They called me, and they said, no one will take them. They're that difficult. I said, why? They could learn. They were really discipline problems.
Mm-hmm.
I was so upset. Because I had to come to school sick, and they looked at me, and I wanted to kill them. I said, "How could you embarrass me? You're the best class." They were horrible, but not with me. And one of the tough boys said, "We can't handle it unless you're here."
Yeah.
What do you say?
Yeah.
I was like, "Yes, you can. No, we can't." I go, "Thank you very much." So
yeah, but it's so nice.
It's
so nice to have someone affirm that you have some strengths. Huh? These kids who are labeled learning disabled from kindergarten, first, second, third grade, and then we put them in the resource room, and then whether it's push in, pull out, it doesn't make a difference. They still know they're different. And then, by the way, you do a lot of research, and you're a much better researcher than am I. However, when you get a chance, if you have nothing to do, that is also oxymoronic because you always have a lot to do. But if you happen to get a moment, try to find the rate of success of children who are placed in special education in the early grades and how they fare straight through.
That's funny you should say that.
Well, there are paucity of studies, first of all, number one, about that for a lot of reasons, probably most of them political. But the ones that are there show that children who are put in, let's just call it special ed, okay, whether it's resource room or self-contained, big difference. But whether children who are put in special ed in first grade are in special ed in sixth grade and graduate from high school, usually with some kind of funny diploma, you know. We've created this monster of a system, and it's self-perpetuating. And I know why it's self-perpetuating. It's self-perpetuating because once a child is labeled learning disabled, and again, I love teachers. Teachers should be getting medals for what they do. However, teachers oftentimes, don't have the background to teach reading if they don't have the big six credits that the New York State requires in reading, which is ridiculous. But special ed teachers who are in charge of these children, you know as well as I do, often these children don't even get a teacher for the whole time they're in the self-contained classroom. They have a teacher aide teaching a youngster 2, 3, 4 years behind in reading how to read. It's impossible. It's absolutely impossible. So if I may, I'm just going to do a little quick segue for him. What you expect, you get. What you expect, you get. And that's a quick way of defining the self-fulfilling prophecy. Yeah? The self-fulfilling prophecy is exactly what you talked about before. If you convince youngsters that they can learn, they will, okay? However, if you convince them that they can't because they have this disability, they're not going to learn. And there was a classic study done in, it was in the 60s by Robert Rosenthal. We took a class and Jacobson, and they took a class, and the school district, of course, allowed them to do this, and the parents signed off on it. And they just said they were looking at, it was a done under a guise, it's called a guise. That's kind of why. But they can't say what they're really doing. But they asked the school district, I think it was second, third graders, and they asked them to give them the IQs of all the kids in two or three classes. And, well, let's talk about just one class anyway, but they used two or three. And they did that, and they gave them the IQs and of Ms. Jones's class. And the teachers had the IQs, researchers had the IQs. They turned them over to the teachers. It was the second week of school. And then they tracked how the kids did. By the end of the year, Fran, the correlation between IQ and their year average, or grade average, or call it A's and B's, whatever, the correlation was over 50%. And I think you know this, but it's not very dramatic when I say this, but this study has been replicated more than a few times. Most recently in, I think, 2017, but many times. And the correlation was incredibly high, over 90%. And the bottom line, the IQs that the teachers were given were made up. They didn't.
I can imagine.
The IQs were made up. They didn't they just assigned them randomly. So not that the teachers made up, I'm sorry, that the researchers got from the school. They just took them and they arbitrarily assigned them. So basically what the researchers were really studying was teachers' perception of the student, how smart he or she was, and how that impacted on performance. You what you expect, you get. Jacobson and Rosenthal basically concluded that in a host of ways, the children who had high IQs were kind of treated differently. They got more time to answer questions, and the teachers didn't realize they were even doing this, but they just treated them differently. And in a lot of not so conscious or obvious ways, and as a result, the youngsters. Conversely, the youngsters with low IQs, when they couldn't get an answer right away, the teacher subconsciously was saying, and in my opinion, that's a self-fulfilling prophecy, also called the Pygmalion effect, based on Robert Shaw's play with Eliza Doolittle, Pygmalion, where they had a bet where he could take the young little flower girl on the street and make her papa into a smoothie. And basically, in 6 months, and he had a bet with his buddy. And he most certainly did. She attended a cocktail party, and she was dressed beautifully. And they, of course, how did they convince her? By doing lessons with her and treating her and showing her proper ways to act, et cetera, et cetera. And she, of course, believed she was a proper young lady, so she was able to be a proper young lady. That Pygmalion effect is critical, and that's the self-fulfilling prophecy in a nutshell. And we're taking millions and millions of children and doing just the opposite with them. Instead of convincing them that they're good, that they have potential, we're going to capitalize on that potential. Instead of doing that, we do just the opposite. We give them a label, and that label tells them, you have something wrong with you, and, try as you may, but it's just not going to happen because you have this problem. In my opinion, that's sinful. I use a different term. That's a travesty. And it's, in my opinion, it's not just American travesty, because if you look at cross-cultural studies, it's done in many countries. The U.S. rates pretty high in terms of learning disabled children, or labeling. I think in the top five, all countries are doing it. It's unbelievable. Australia and New Zealand probably have the lowest, believe it or not, because they're not all that big on the whole labeling idea. They're much bigger on teaching. That's why the reading recovery program came out of New Zealand.
It bothers me, it's funny because I had a group that came in, and they weren't supposed to be there, really, at 7 o'clock in the morning, and they were It was everybody. It was anybody that needed help with reading.
Uh-huh.
And they came in. They were, a lot of them weren't below level. They didn't know. And I just said, good morning. Why are you here? They said, because you're here. And they came to drive
yeah.
me crazy? Okay, no problem. And
right.
some of them were special ed, and some of them were resource. And I got in trouble. I said, you can't yell at me. The state came in to yell at me, the guy.
Yeah.
And I said, I will call the media. I will call the Post. I will call Channel 12. This is my coffee time. You can't tell me what to do.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a required reading group. They came because they want to be here, because they know they're going to succeed, because there's no such thing as not doing better. And the guy
mm-hmm.
looked at me. I said, you could write me up. And they did. You could write me up. You could say whatever you want to say. But I'm going to tell you now, I'm going to go to the media. This is my coffee time from 7 in the morning till a quarter to 9. Don't tell me what to do. And my principal
right.
was standing there. He said, you're right. Don't start with her.
Yeah.
It was like,
yeah.
because these kids, my friend teaches special ed, and she says they can't read. I said, yes, they can, because this is how you do it. This is how you start
right.
with them.
Right.
And their first is that, but if the teacher has an attitude that they're not going to learn, the teacher says they're behind. And I did reading. I snuck into special ed. So some of the teachers said, can you work on comprehension? Can you teach us how to do this? And they were not that far behind. They're
right.
not. But
right.
it depends on, and special ed, I mean, I maybe it's just my belief, if somebody's in special ed in kindergarten, first grade, why are they still there in sixth grade? You're doing something wrong.
Well yeah, Brenda, and there you go. That's in a nutshell, in my view. The two, three things we're talking about this morning, iatrogenic reading disorders, self-fulfilling prophecy, the Pygmalion effect, these are so critically important. When youngsters are labeled so early on, they feel like failures and they become failures in school. And they end up, by the way, the dropout rate of youngsters, especially those in the self-contained classrooms, is incredibly high. In my view, what we really need to do is we have to, instead of, I hate the term in fact, you know, if I'm going on a stream of consciousness here, but why is it just education where we label performance? Let's think about it. I'm going to be a little silly here, but not really. I'm not very mechanically inclined. But do you see, friend, like the doorknob fell off the front door and my wife asked me if I could, actually that's not lying, because she could fix it. She's really good. But I couldn't fix it. But you see, it's not my fault. It's not my fault I couldn't fix it because I have this mechanic here. Huh? Okay? Now, have you ever heard of that, friend? This mechanic here?
Yeah.
Of course not. I just made it up. Huh? Now, also, I'm not great with directions, like how to find my way to, I don't know, if I had to get into somewhere in New England, and I'm going to get lost. There's no doubt about it. Thank God for GPS. But I have this dyslexia. There were some people I was at a wedding. They had this dyslexia. You'll never hear terms like that. Why is it that we just medicalize? Those are all just underperformance, right? Why
mm-hmm.
is it that we label underperformance in education? Why must we educate? I have no problem saying that youngster really is struggling with reading. He's struggling. He needs a lot of work in reading. He needs help. I don't have a problem with that. But once you assign that label, because when you need, I need help fixing the doorknob. That's okay. I'll have somebody do it for me. Okay? But once you're assigned that label, you're not, it's so incredibly difficult to get over it. And my heart stops. Special ed teachers, I have some relatives who are special ed teachers, they spend so much time, friend, and you know this, so much time doing paperwork and writing IEPs and doing their quarterly reports and signing off on this and signing off on that. That's why they actually need more people in the classroom with them, because they have to spend so much time doing all of this. I'm sorry, I'm going to call it nonsense, because it's kind of like what do they call it? When you take an activity and you break it down into all its subparts, and they have to do the EPs and spend so much time. To be honest with you, in my view, I've looked at IEPs, and I don't see a single benefit other than making it look like, well, okay, we got a real handle on this, or I'm going to document how bad this kid really is. And I'm going to put a plan in place, but the plan in place is going to be very difficult to achieve in a class of 20, mm-hmm. almost impossible to achieve in a 1 to 10 classroom with one teacher and two aides. And so nothing's going to happen with it anyway. So we really set up a system that I don't know if all of a sudden they say, well, Cavuto, you do podcasts, you're teaching a few classes at the university, but you're kind of retired. Would you like to make a recommendation for the New York State? Oh yes, I'd like to make one for. Let's do away with this whole learning disability movement that we're in. Let's do away with it. You want to say the youngster has difficulty reading? Fine. But once we call it a disability, it's now become a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's now become...
We have about 5 minutes, so what do we want to talk about now? I know. And then they tell the parent, and then the parent relays it to the child instead of saying, I have faith in you, they lose it. So what's
and you
the
know,
next
and you
one?
Know what? And you're right, friend, and you know what? This goes back to something we talked about probably 2 years ago, but the medicalization of education. Once we medicalize the youngster's educational problem, believe it or not, I apologize. Of course you believe it. But once we medicalize it, everybody's off the hook. The school is off the hook because it's not their fault. He's got dyslexia. Of course they can't teach him to read on grade level. The parents off the hook, you're doing something wrong. Are you practicing with him? Do you make sure he reads at night? Well, I would, but he's got dyslexia, so he's off the hook. And you know what? The child's off the hook because there's no reason why he has to learn to read anymore, right? And in his IEP, what does it say in his IEP? Do not have the children take tests in writing. He can't read them, so things have to be read to him, right? How is that going to make him a better reader? It's a perverse system we've set up, and it's really upsetting. It's really upsetting, and I just wish we could do something about it, and collectively, the education people in this country, and get away from this very, very negative view of children
The problem is that they use one program in a class. We have about 2 minutes, They use one program, and I never did that. If this group needed this, then I took another program for that. I didn't follow anything. I did what I wanted, and it worked. And then when I taught IGC sixth grade, I didn't use a reader at all. I used Sherlock Holmes, Edgar Allan Poe. I used stuff that was going to interest them and want to read. But I don't think in the 19 years that I did reading groups or reading whatever, there was not one group that ever came down and said, I don't want to be here. And there's not one group that said, this isn't fun. And I found stuff on their grade level that was of interest to them. So whether it was a rap singer or whether it was a boxer or somebody, one day a week we read comprehension on their level or a little above. And... Mm-hmm. They did better. There was no such thing as I can't learn. They would say, we're here. So what's the topic for the next one? And I have my schedule in front of me. I'm losing my mind with this schedule.
Let's see. We did touch on self-fulfilling prophecy. We did touch on iatrogenic disorders. But I think in an hour, we did pretty nicely. I don't know. I think we're going to have to give it a little bit of thought where we go next with our talks. I would love to do AI, but I'm not terribly well versed in it. But I did see an interview with Elon Musk yesterday who predicted that already now AI is booming to the extent that already they can make machines that are smarter than most human beings. And by next year, he prophesied, they're going to be able to make machines that are smarter than any human being in the world. I heard that. I got like a shiver. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a mirror learning and there's elite learning. I've looked it up. But to be very honest, I would never use AI in a classroom. I have to do it myself. And I don't know if they said that the kids are reading, but the AI intelligence is telling them, you know, what to do. So are they reading out loud? Are they reading silently? Can they read that? I would learn more about it. But to be honest, there's nothing like a teacher knowing what they're doing. So
exactly.
I could do August 14th. Does that work?
August 14th? Let's see. I don't have my calendar.
If I don't do anything in July, I take the month off.
I know that. Well, what day of the week is that, friend?
It's a Wednesday. Is that all right?
Yeah. That's more important than even the date. The day of the week is good. Wednesday is fine. August 14th, Wednesday.
Okay, and you'll tell me when I'm going to do the research on, and I'll do it. So everyone, listen on Monday. The author of Fast Times in the Big City will be here. I have three next week, right? On Wednesday, the author of Some Kind of Truth is excellent. And New York Times author Dana Perry, Dick Belsky, R.G. Belsky, three names. I had to read three books in order to do the interview on Thursday. The Nowhere Girls, The Lost One, The Last to Die, and The Lost Ones, and I got to memorize. But Dr. Cavuto, thank you so much. Just let me know what I have to do so I can get started. Everybody, it's a beautiful day, and bye.
Bye-bye.